You go, man.
I think this is good now. So we are recording now. All right. So I am Helix, and you're listening to Greenlight Radio. I'm here live with Brother Ali. Why don't you say hello?
Hello.
Hello. So why don't we just jump right into it? First of all, we are here in Boulder on your leg of your tour for your new album, Morning in America, Dreaming in Color. And what stop are we now?
Like, what number city is this?
Yeah.
I don't even know what day of the week today is. You know what I mean? I have no idea. Like, tour is like a vacuum, you know what I mean? It's like a portal.
Yeah.
Like, you jump into it and you lose track of the rest of the world. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Every day is Friday to me.
All right. Saturday night, there you go.
Exactly. Over and over and over again.
One after another. Well, that's exciting. So, so you have your new album that just dropped in September, right? September, okay. And so, first question is, where does the inspiration behind the album lie?
It's a message album. People call it political, and that's okay if you're talking about the older, like the more traditional definition of what political is. People now, you know, nowadays, politics has come to mean this kind of, you know, horse race between the Democrats and the Republicans, particularly now. You know, we see all this, you know, every time you turn TV, there's like ads. Mitt Romney says that this, but he really does this. Obama doesn't want you to know that he's gonna so-and-so, like, you know, and all of the coverage is just talking about the competition between them. That's not the kind of politics that I'm dealing with. I'm dealing with the kind of politics with the older definition that says that we ought to have some sort of concern with the collective way that life is lived and experienced in our communities, in our neighborhoods, in our states, in our country, and in the world. That kind of politics I am dealing with. And I believe that we're in a really dismal time that we should really be honest about who we are, what we've become, what we've allowed ourselves to become involved in, and just kind of reassess who we want to be, you know, and start taking steps to become that.
Absolutely. So on the first track of that album, Letter to My Countrymen, you had Cornel West on there with you as well. How was working with him, and what was that about?
Well, I stalk him because I'm such a huge fan of his. You know,
I agree. I am too.
Yeah, him and Questlove are two people that I just will pop out of nowhere and just yo, Charlie Murphy. Like, yeah, those are my two kind of. Questlove on the music side, Dr. West on the, you know, on the philosophical side. But it was really cool. Like, I tracked them down through mutual friends that we had. And eventually it was really hard to get a hold of him because he doesn't have a computer. And he just got a cell phone. Like, I learned that he just got his first cell phone.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's hard to get a hold of him. You know what I mean? Like, he has a phone with the old school answering machine at his house. You know what I mean? So you call that, and it's just like, how many messages are on here? Because he can't get email. You can't Facebook message him. You can't, like, you know.
Exactly.
So I finally got a hold of his assistant, who told me to write him an email, which I thought was interesting because I know he doesn't use computers, but she printed it and put it on his desk, and he called me the next day. And sure enough, I guess him and Lupe Fiasco had been talking about me and stuff. And so I went out there and spent a whole day with him. And since then, we've had some correspondence. Like, I mean, we went at like 10 in the morning until like after midnight.
Really?
Like a full day, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was really great. Yeah.
I'm sure that's really inspiring to be hanging out with Cornel West.
Yes, I'm hoping to do more.
Yeah.
Hoping we can do some more stuff together, too.
That's great. So I want to ask about just this long journey it's been. I remember seeing you, for the first time here at the Fox, because I'm from Boulder.
Mm.
And so seeing you, like, more than 10 years ago, you know.
No, just 10 years ago.
Yeah, seems like it.
No.
Yeah, all right, yeah. So 10 years ago. Right?
Yeah, thank you.
And, it's just must be such a long journey, and I'm just curious about kind of what has changed. You keep coming back to Boulder. Obviously, you feel the love. People here are so into what you're doing.
Yeah.
And I'm just
people here have a lot of time and money. to enjoy stuff, to enjoy art and stuff. You know what I mean? That's really what it is. People just have a lot of time on their hands and a lot of money to support things that they like, you know? So that's why everybody keeps coming here. It's kind of like, it's kind of similar to like Europe, you know, how like people like, artists like love going to Europe. Yeah, I mean, it's been a lot of different phases. It's like, you know, a third of my life on the road, you know what I mean? It's a trip, you know?
As a family man, has that been hard for you?
Very, very hard, yeah. I haven't figured out how to balance it yet. I started in 2002, and this was my 10th anniversary tour, you know what I mean? It's like, I've been doing this 10 years now. But started in 2002, and that year I did 5 months on the road. And I thought that that was crazy, but I wanted to do more. So then I did 6, then I did 8, then I did 9. And then by 2010, I did 10 months on the road. And that was too much, and my family almost didn't make it. And it was just really, really, it was one of, you know, worst times of my life. Even though my, like, professionally it was going really, really well. And I decided to get off the road for a little while against everybody's suggestion. Nobody thought that that was a good idea. Mm-hmm. But I needed to do that. And, you know, I needed to feel like a person again and not just feel like this entertainer thing that just gets on stage no matter what. Mm-hmm. And I had, like, you know, personal tragedies. My dad died. My dear friend Idea died. You know, me and my wife are, like, talking about how is this sustainable? Mm-hmm. Can we really have a family like this? Are we really a family right now? Mm-hmm. But every day, you know, like my dad died, flew home, buried him, flew right back to Europe, got on stage like it was like nothing ever happened. And I got to say who and all this other stuff. Like, man, I'm not able to process life like a person, you know. Same thing with Idea. You know, I got the news that Idea died, and then I did a show that night.
That night.
Yeah. And then the night after, you know what I mean?
Yeah. That's rough.
And then I canceled a show on the day of his funeral, and I got like really angry letters from fans. They were like, "How dare you cancel a show?" I'm just like, man, I need to reclaim my life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so now being back after, you know, it's been 3 years since we released the album, 2 years since we've been on tour. Mm-hmm. And there are some places, Colorado's not one of them, but there are some places where I feel like I have to build it back up again, mm-hmm. get people back used to, you know, in the habit of coming to see us every 6 months or something. But, so I've never found a way to balance it. I toured too much, and then I toured not enough. And so now hopefully I'll be a little smarter and be a little bit more selective with the things that I agree to do.
Right. Man of the extremes over here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's different about doing shows, say, here in Boulder versus, like, back in the Midwest?
The you know, the spirit of the crowd is just different based on how life is lived. Like I said, in Boulder, you know, people have money and people have time. And that has so much, that's a huge effect on the way that people interact with art. You know what I mean? Because our society doesn't give people enough time to really think much about anything.
Absolutely.
Which is why surface entertainment is so popular. Because we don't have time to think the thoughts that are going to come from watching and listening to and reading things that are really deep. You don't need to, that's going to set a fire inside you. And then when am I going to process that? I don't have time for that. You know, so I watch, you know, Ice Loves Coco and listen to, you know, pop music or whatever. There's a lot of underground pop music. There's a lot of stuff that sounds like underground rap, but it's really pop music.
Yeah. So that actually leads into another question of mine really well. What makes hip-hop and good music and true music, I've heard you say before, versus this mainstream radio music?
Well, first of all, I like a lot of the mainstream radio music for what it's everybody has a job to play in life. You know, if you got a big family, some people in the family are the people that you go to when you're crying and depressed. Other people are the ones you go to when you just want to have fun. And artists are the same way. You know, you can't expect somebody to make art that's bigger or more or different than who they are as a person. So some people are just, you know, just that guy or that lady that's just, you know, the everyday pleasures of life are just so whatever to them. But
yeah,
I mean, I would say that pop music reminds me of somebody who wants you to love them, so they just want to get from you, mm-hmm. you know. And so they do the safest things. They do what you know you want. You just don't know you want it yet.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Uh-huh. So they make a song about the trend in life that nobody's made that song yet. So they look at the trend, they look at what you're already doing, they study you, and then they make the song that your life is missing.
You want to hear.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's pop music, and that's, you know, when somebody loves you. And now I equate that to the kind of art that I do. When somebody is loving rather than just looking to be loved and wants to have a real relationship with you, they tell you the truth about themselves, about yourself, about the world, about whatever. They tell you the truth and worry later about whether or not it's what you want to hear or how you're going to react to it. And that's what I'm saying. There's, you know, there's music now that's disguised as underground artistic shit. You know what I mean? But it's not.
Yeah, it's an illusion.
They're totally just, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're doing some things that sonically remind us of underground stuff. But they're really just giving you the song. They're very calculated about giving you the song that you want. And that's in the underground. So I wouldn't just criticize the mainstream for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the I would almost say that the... that there's a new wave of pop underground rap that is pop music, though. Mm-hmm. It's not popular, but it's in terms of the way that it's approached is like pop music.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing wrong with that. It all has its place, you know.
Yeah, it all does have its place.
Yeah.
So then what influences your music and rhyme style?
Well, I've been doing this my whole life. I don't know how to do anything else. I never tried to do anything else. Mm-hmm. I didn't graduate from high school. I got D's in every class I ever took just because my teachers thought that I shouldn't fail. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So they just gave me a D so I could go on. I never really cared about a job. I never cared. You know, I did a lot of jobs, you know, to feed my family. But I do this because it's who I am. I have to do it. I don't have a choice. Mm-hmm. And that's another difference. You get people that are like, man, How can I be successful? They choose music or choose art almost like a career, you know. Or they choose a genre that they're not even part of.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, oh, these, you know, kids love rap now. Well, I can rap. Oh, no big deal. Like, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, that is what it is. But
so how did you get started in hip-hop?
When I was 7 and 8 years old. My first show was when I was 8 years old. My grandmother's funeral. And I killed it.
You played?
It's a terrible joke. Yeah, yeah.
No pun intended.
Mm-hmm. No, I did great.
That's awesome.
And I wanted to just get that feeling over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So here I'm 35, still trying to get that feeling over and over again.
Mm-hmm. So today, who do you listen to? You know, if you were to go see a live show, who would you want to go see?
I listen to a lot of stuff. Like, mm-hmm. In terms of... like my favorite music is soul music, you know, R&B music, old rap.
Mm-hmm.
I like some jazz. I like some blues. But to me, a lot of them are gone. But I mean, you know, Nina Simone, Marvin Gaye.
Mm-hmm. Classics.
Yeah. You know, Gil Scott-Heron,
mm-hmm.
Stevie Wonder. You know. People like that. For rap, in terms of new rap, like, I'm still a really big Roots fan.
Mm-hmm.
I've been listening to their newest album, which is like a year or so old now, but
mm-hmm.
I've been listening to that every day recently.
Yeah.
I just really love it. Uh-huh. I like Kendrick Lamar a lot. And then the people that are on the tour with us are some of my favorites right now, like mm-hmm. the Reminders mm-hmm. group from here.
Mm-hmm.
And then also Homeboy Sandman, and a few others. There's a dude named Bamboo, a guy from California named Bamboo. I like his stuff a lot. There's a guy named Jasiri X from Pittsburgh that I like a lot. I still love Immortal Technique. I still love my friends. Immortal Technique, Atmosphere, you know, Merce, Aesop Rock, Mm-hmm. I like LP's record a lot. I love Killer Mike's album that they made together. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of good music, man. But Kendrick Lamar is a future rapper.
Yeah.
Everybody seems to agree. Mm-hmm. Everybody that matters. Some people would probably pick some white person instead, but Kendrick Lamar is the future of rap. And the white people that they pick rap like Kendrick Lamar, they just don't know it because they don't listen to Kendrick Lamar.
Well, there you go. You have it right here first. Kendrick Lamar, future of rap. let's see here. So, kind of getting a little bit heavier, what role do you think hip-hop plays in this movement, in this feeling of revolution that is in the air everywhere?
Well, I think that hip-hop comes from a people who have no choice but to be revolutionary, to keep track of their humanity. Like, our country is built on some people having privilege and because of other people's oppression. Mm-hmm. And it's been that way from the beginning. The language doesn't say that. So that's the redeeming quality in it, that the language was right from the beginning. It's never been true for everybody. Mm-hmm. So the revolution that needs to happen now is to make that language true for everybody in a way that it's never been. We have a good opportunity to do that now because now it's almost not true for anybody. Mm-hmm. That American dream, you know, the elite, wealthy, greedy people have always been really good at keeping a middle class buffer in between the few elite people and the masses. And so, you know, they give a little bit more to that middle class and make their lives comfortable and give them toys and then get them to sympathize with the rich against the poor. Mm-hmm. And they police the poor. You know what I mean? Socially, they vote against the poor, even though they're only one notch above them. And the totem pole, they vote against the poor. They vote in favor of the rich, all this stuff. But greed has an inherent flaw. Self-destructive flaw that it can never just be satisfied. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the people that are at the top, they started robbing that middle class more and more and more and more and more. And so now the middle class that used to act as their, you know, their security blanket, now a lot of them are in the fight.
Right. You know?
And I've witnessed that firsthand. Like, I've been in activist situations with people who have, you know, from my lifetime, had no business being there.
Absolutely.
You know, middle class, middle-aged, privileged people, mm-hmm. that are fighting because they've started to get a sense of what it means to suffer. You know, they're reawakening to the idea of what it means to have justice and have, you know, freedom.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it's good. I think it's a, you know, it's a very rough place. You asked about hip-hop's role in that. I don't think hip-hop has any more role than any other kind of art. I think that the mainstream society judges hip-hop in a really unfair way and has unfair expectations of hip-hop, almost as if it needs to prove its legitimacy or its usefulness to society, you know. So the fact that hip-hop has been used to do positive things doesn't mean that that's hip-hop's job. Mm-hmm. Hip-hop's job is to be the expression of people that have a lot to say.
And never had a voice before.
Well, or the, all the other voices before were stolen.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
You can't take an actual voice, but, you know, the voice comes from within inside you. But, you know, every other genre of music was stolen and appropriated and, you know, all this other stuff. So hip-hop has done some good things, but that doesn't mean that hip-hop has more or less of a responsibility than any other culture or any other person. You know, we could be saying, well, like, you know, what should the Catholics be doing for, you know what I mean? Or what should, you know, you never hear somebody say, like, what should the Samba community be doing for, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. So, getting back into your,
and that's an attempt to own other people's culture. By way of critiquing it and determining for somebody else's culture what inside that culture is legitimate and what isn't.
Right.
That's an attempt to colonize their culture.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to be careful about that. People that look like me and you, because we come from 500 to 1,000 years of that. you know, it's kind of in our genes at this point. We gotta actively fight against it.
So you were recently arrested for an Occupy Homes movement, I believe it was in Minneapolis in June, is that mm-hmm. correct? Mm-hmm. So what happened exactly? Do you mind getting into the details?
No, the Occupy Homes is something that grew out of the general Occupy movement, mm-hmm. and it's common people getting together to basically fight for homeowners that are being unjustly foreclosed and evicted from their homes, and their lives being just destroyed, and the banks are quickly and quietly turning yet another profit on poor people and our homes.
Right.
So the idea is to, you know, meet with people who are in foreclosure, you know, but did everything that they could, did everything they were supposed to do, did everything right. Hear their story, broadcast their story, get support for what they're doing, then put pressure on the bank to renegotiate with them. Because mm-hmm. most of the time, the banks never even meet with these people. These are people, a lot of them have been paying on a house for 10 years, faithfully making mortgage payments, plus the down payment that they made, mm-hmm. and then lose a job, lose funding, something like that, and they miss a couple payments. So they go get two part-time jobs to make up for the full-time job they had. Start sending payments in. The bank mails their payments back. You're in foreclosure. We're not going to meet with you. You know, unless you can pay your house off, we're going to take your house. Mm-hmm. And that has been happening across the country. So get together, put pressure on the bank to renegotiate or to actually sit down and meet with them. And then if the bank refuses to do that and they sell the house out from underneath them, which they do a lot, then the authorities get notice of it, and we go and talk to them and tell them, don't send your sheriffs to evict these people until we have time to look into if there's a solution. And most of the time we have success in one of those areas. If not, then the police come, and then we go and defend the home, and people get arrested, and you know, it's nonviolent, and it's you know, it's, and so at this particular house we had 37 people get arrested. They tried to charge some of the organizers with rioting. You know, these are people that we have on tape. They're sitting on the ground, locked arms, looking down, not even looking anybody in the eye, and they charged them with rioting. So we said, okay, until you drop those rioting charges, all 37 of us are going to trial individually. So you need 37 judges, 37 juries, 37 prosecutors, and we all want public defenders. Mm-hmm. And we can just be dealing with this for the next 2 years.
Right.
And we're all going to keep on postponing and delaying and everything else.
Absolutely.
My case is still pending.
Is it?
Yep.
So that's also what I was going to ask about, your following incarceration details.
Still pending. I only had to do one night while we were actually there. Mm-hmm. And then my wife was nice enough to bail me out. Yeah. And
lovely women.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great.
And so we'll see. They're trying to, I mean, right now what the charge I'm fighting is trespassing, but the reality is that I was a guest of the family who rightfully owned that home. Mm-hmm. The fact that the bank sold their mortgage or their property out from underneath them isn't my fault.
Right.
And once, you know, there will be a time where that'll come to light.
Right.
So I'm trying to hold out until then to say, well, you're saying I was trespassing. Legally, technically, yes, but that was unjust, you know.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, having people out there and actually doing something is what needs to happen. It's a big part of it.
Absolutely.
Instead of just talking about it, I feel like that's kind of what's been happening at least a lot about in Boulder as well. It's like there's all this talk, you know, but like nobody actually has enough balls to go out and do something.
Or people go out and they do things that make them feel better but don't help the movement.
Absolutely.
You know, I see a lot of people that are mad and they want to fight the cops and they want to get arrested, mm-hmm. and then they feel like a martyr. You know, you go talk crazy to a cop and then they kick your ass, and then you say, the cops beat me up, man, and you feel like a martyr. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Getting arrested, you got to be careful with that too. Mm-hmm. It's very alluring. It sounds cool. You know what I mean? But the time that I got arrested, our local news had stopped talking about our movement, and they were just completely ignoring it. Mm-hmm. So then when I got arrested again, they started covering it again. So it was a strategic thing that wasn't just for me to say, look what a badass I am. Because it was nothing. I mean, compared to what, you know, compared to what, you know, innocent people of color go through who didn't do anything at all.
Absolutely.
Every day on the streets of every city in America, mm-hmm. it was nothing. You know what I mean? but that doesn't make me cool. It just brought attention to something again that needs attention.
So how do you feel about the EU getting the Peace Prize?
I think that the Peace Prize is officially a joke. I think that I think that you know, there's been some people that have gotten that Peace Prize, like Dr. King, who their name doesn't deserve to be on the same list with the EU.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And even with President Obama, mm-hmm. he doesn't deserve his either.
Mm-hmm.
This is a person that sends remote control airplanes to blow up people's family homes.
Absolutely.
American citizens on top of that. Not like American life is more precious than anybody else, but how do you get a Peace Prize for that? How do those people can't even defend themselves if they shoot the plane down? There's nobody in the plane. It doesn't
even matter. They'll send another one.
Yeah.
They'll push another fucking button from Virginia.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that kind of goes into another one. Are you actually a registered voter?
Yes.
You are.
Yep.
So where do you see the future of our country going? I mean, this is such a big year. I feel, you know, like there's so many different things that are in debate, and I feel like it's kind of maybe a turning point. May not be.
Mm.
How do you feel about that?
Well, if we have the choice between the two guys that are running, I'd rather see Obama in president than Romney, but not because I think that would be a turning point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he's shown us anything that makes us think that he's going to do anything radical now. You know, we can have hope, I guess, but the reality is that I think that we should vote because too many people died for voting rights.
Absolutely.
And that's an avenue we should keep open. And we should participate in every way that we can, by all means necessary, every way that we can participate, we should. But Obama's election shows that we took the most bright, perfect message, you know, highest quality leader that we've had in our public life, in our generation, and put them in the most powerful seat. And we see that, you know, that didn't change our lives, and that didn't change our reality. So it's good to put people like that in that position. But now we need a social movement. We need a very strong social movement that demands things and that puts our hands on things and disrupts things in a nonviolent way, but disrupt things, you know.
Absolutely, or else there's going to be nothing different, you know. I think it's a hand-in-hand kind of coalition that needs to happen.
Yeah, that money is just way too deep.
Yeah.
And the same people pay for both sides,
right?
The same people. So no matter who wins, Goldman Sachs is in.
Yep.
They're in the White House no matter what.
Yeah.
You know.
Pay to be there. Exactly. It doesn't matter if it's Obama or Romney. I mean, is anything really going to be different?
Well, yeah. You can't say that they'd be the same,
mm-hmm.
because say we have this. So because you know, for a lot of reasons. But say we do have a social movement. Who's going to be more likely to honor that movement? Because it won't be Mitt Romney.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? So I would never say that they're the same.
Yeah.
They're not the same. Obama is a lot better, but the bar is so low for him to be better than them. You know what I mean? The bar is set so incredibly low that we're celebrating accomplishments like killing Osama bin Laden, you know, but we don't have a jobs bill. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're celebrating, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. It can be really frustrating, I feel, and some people can really lose track of the bigger picture and just get distracted, and I think it can be really depressing sometimes.
Well, the idea is to be tied into a legacy, to understand that we're tied into a legacy of people who gave their lives and their freedom and their careers and everything, their comforts. They gave up all the worldly pleasures in the world to do what they could in their time.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't change the entire world, but they did change things significantly because of the level of their commitment. So if we say now, you know, F it, man, it's too far gone, can't do anything, just give up, we're letting ourselves off too easy and we're not affirming. I mean, think about what Assata Shakur did. Think about what Malcolm did. Think about what Leonard Peltier did. Think about what all of these people, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, even, you know, Robert Kennedy and, you know, all these people. Howard Zinn spent his life, gave his whole career, You know, he could have been rich and famous, and he chose to be poor and satisfied in telling the truth.
And honest.
And honest, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So for us to just say, like, I'm depressed, you know what I mean?
Fuck
Get the fuck out of here. You're depressed. What are you depressed about? We haven't sacrificed enough to be depressed.
Absolutely. We have EPA quality water in our fucking toilets. You know, people don't even have that to drink, and we have it in our toilets. We shit on it every single day. I mean, that's just, it's fucked up, I think. Just a few more questions. How has your religious and racial background affected your music career and developed you as a person?
I mean, that's a huge, I'd probably write a book about that.
Yeah. Short cut version.
I mean, it just gave me a very unique
idea. Especially in this country, though. I mean, being a Muslim, how does that affect you every day?
It just enables it's better tools to care. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't touch my life because I'm white, so I get to do whatever I want. You do all kind of crazy shit. I mean, you're white. It's just, people respond. Oh, that's, I think that's really deep, that you know, different. Very, very different. That Muhammad Ali showed, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, if Jack Dempsey had said those things, they'd be celebrating the shit out of him. He's a heroic freedom fighter, you know. And then we love looking back, and we love, like, going back and giving credit for things that don't matter anymore now. Like, now we're celebrating Muhammad Ali as the most famous person. And we should. He's great, one of the greatest heroes ever in American life. But while that was going on, that shit wasn't happening. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, says we do that with everything. We like looking at what we did wrong in the past, because it doesn't affect us now, and because it helps us feel like we've made progress. You know what I mean? Which is ridiculous, but it just gave me it just helps me have a more profound outlook on life, so that when I write a song, or the reasons why I do what I do are just different. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, anybody that's ever suffered just does what they do for a different reason.
Yeah.
Than the people who haven't suffered.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, so this is kind of just like a general question I usually ask everybody. How do you feel about pirating music compared to, you know, because there's such higher sales in live shows than record deals. So what is your stance on the pirate scene?
There's a song on my album called One More Hit.
Mm-hmm.
Where I basically outline the whole, you know, history of the American music. Mm-hmm. American music has from the beginning been built on stealing music from the people that create it. That's our entire legacy of, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The business side of what we do has been stealing music from the people that make it. And so it's only, like, I think that the industry is after years of benefiting from that and getting fat off that. Mm-hmm. Now for them to be feeling, now they're being robbed too.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah, you know, I do, at home we have this festival that we do called Soundset, and there's like 20,000 people there, and I do a song and everybody's saying every word. And I'm like, man, if everybody here that knows and enjoys this song had to buy it, my life would be very different.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have to tour 10 months out of the year to be comfortable, you know.
Yeah.
And still not have health insurance sometimes, you know. My life would be very different, but it just is what it is at this point. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have a lot of patience when people hit me on Twitter and they're like, man, can you help a broke so-and-so get, you know, can you help a broke college student get into the show tonight? Can I come in for free, or can I? I mean, motherfuckers, if they didn't have to pay for the show, they wouldn't pay for that either. If they didn't have to pay for the merch, they wouldn't pay for that either.
Yeah.
There's just a class of people like that. But then there are some people that are very, very supportive. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And that they do believe in it, the people that really get it. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that, like, my first week sales have stayed the same. Like, for this album was the same as my most successful album, which is 5 years ago. The music industry was better now. So that, my most successful one prior to this was, like, 69 on Billboard. This time I sold the same amount, but it was 44.
Yeah.
Because everybody stopped buying all the other music. But there's that group of people that are still, they're like, no, I want to be a part of this. I want it. I want the real thing. I want to own it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, if it's something that we care about, we should support it somehow financially, because it costs money to make.
Yeah. So,
My last question is, what advice would you have for, you know, this frustrated generation's feeling of revolution? What would you say to them? Do you try and translate that through your music as well?
Start with a willingness to sacrifice and give something up. Because the reality is that we're all privileged, or all privileged in some way. So if we're not willing to work against our own unjust advantages, unfair advantages that we have, everybody across the board, if we're not willing to fight those, then we can't expect or ask or demand anybody else to fight theirs.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when I see, I see people talking about they're revolutionary, but they're doing nothing and they're completely blind to their own privilege, whether it's male privilege, white privilege, middle class privilege, first world country privilege, able-bodiedness, straightness, you know what I mean? Whatever it is, like if we're not willing to undo the system that gives us an unfair advantage, then we can't expect anybody else to undo theirs. You know, that's why I think it has to start like that.
Absolutely, I think that's good advice. Just lastly, do you mind doing like a couple drops or anything? So I don't know, Green Light Radio, 95.3 FM, whatever you want to say.
What's up, you guys? It's Brother Ali. I'm in the mix right now. Green Light Radio, 95.3 FM. Stay right here. Is that good?
Yeah.
Cool.
Thank you so much once again. So yeah, this is Helix, and I'm with Brother Ali right here in Boulder.
Yes, yes. I love this station. I love you guys.
Thanks a lot, man.
What's the name of